This is Dawn Fobbs, business development consultant, author, and co-host of the Mother-Daughter-ish podcast and shows. And you are listening to the Ghost in the Valley podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Ghost in the Valley podcast. I'm your host, Al Cooley. Today I have Dave Hodrian as my guest. Dave is the chairman and lead investigator for the Birmingham UFO group out of the UK, also known as BUFOG. Dave has investigated hundreds of UFO sightings. Dave Hodrian has also been involved in over 100 contact cases around the world. Dave Hodrian has spoken at numerous conferences and has appeared on television and radio. He is a regular columnist for UFO Truth magazine. And I'll be right back with my conversation with Dave Hodrian right after these brief messages. Here is a promo for the UFO card game UFO Wave by Dave Hodrian. That will be out soon on Amazon.co.uk with plans for international orders in due course.
Are you receiving me?
Yes, Commander. Loud and clear. What are your orders?
I need you to get out there and cause the mischief. But watch out. As always, the humans will be there to stop you. Their military patrols the skies. They watch us from the ground. And the less said about those pesky men in black, the better. You were authorized to use our highly advanced craft to accomplish your goals. And don't forget to make the most of our abilities, too. The humans won't know what hit them. UFO Wave, the tactical card game of alien supremacy.
The UFO Wave card game will be available Amazon.co.uk.
Have you ever felt life is a fast-moving train? It doesn't stop long enough to give you time to process what's happening. Has life thrown you some curveballs and you don't know exactly how to restart? You've come to the right place. I'm Kathy Brooks, the host of The Kathy Brooks Show. Come discover three pillars, spirit, soul, and body, how they connect with your life experiences and how growing in these areas can impact everything. Want to learn more? Take this journey with me. Tune in Sundays, 7 Central on Stunner Radio.
Okay, today I have Dave Hodrian, and I threw a whole bunch of cases back at Dave to talk about on the show. And he said, if I went through all those, we'd be on for, what do you say, Dave, about 8 hours. So
probably several years.
Right. So we're going to talk about three today, and I'm going to have him come back on, and we're going to talk about another three, and we'll go over a few more cases. How's that sound?
Yeah, it's absolutely great. Yeah, always happy to discuss cases we looked into.
And welcome to the show, Dave. Before we get started, what actually led you into UFO crashes and aliens and all that?
Yeah, so it's interesting. Well, like many people, I've had an interest in paranormal, unsolved mysteries and all that since quite an early age. Just I remember in my childhood reading lots of interesting books on the subject. And I think in my early teens, I started to focus more on the UFO subject. It became particularly fascinating to me. And the more you look into the subject, the more you realize just the amount of evidence that there is on record supporting the reality of the subject. And the way I saw it is there were hundreds and hundreds of cases. And I thought that even if some of these are made up or fictional accounts are embellished, there's got to be some truth to all this. And that just absolutely fascinated me, the idea that we could be being visited by other intelligent beings and what was going on with the subject. And then around age 16, I started going to UFO conferences. I live in Solihull, which is just south of Birmingham in England. We're right in the middle of the country, about as far away as you can get from the sea. And the UFO magazine at the time, it was one of the biggest UFO publications, international magazine. They started holding their yearly conferences in Solihull, which was brilliant because I wasn't driving at the time, but I could get in on a bus and go to the conference, which is excellent. And that was the first time that I saw researchers actively talking, people that were on the front lines with this subject and talking about cases they'd looked into. And sometimes there was actual witnesses talking about their experiences. And that was absolutely amazing. And I did wonder even back then, you know, what that would be like to be actively involved with this subject and speak to people who are seeing all these fascinating things. Yeah, really, that's kind of where my background lay. For many years, just had a very active interest in the UFO subject. I'd read magazines, watch documentaries, you know, everything else that went along with it. But in late 2007, there was the creation of the group, Birmingham UFO Group. And that at that point, that became my essentially my way into active investigation. I wasn't always the chairman of the group, nor did I come up with it. The group was actually started by another couple of gents named Craig and Mark, who lived in an area of Birmingham. And I just came across it online and I thought, this is brilliant. So Birmingham's the second biggest city in England. And I thought, it's a big enough city to kind of warrant having its own independent UFO group. So I thought it was absolutely great when they set that up. And myself and my brother were two of the first members of Birmingham UFO Group. So we started going down to the monthly meetings, which just really kicked off in the corner of a pub. And it was just really good just going down there and just chatting with people who had a like-minded interest in the subject. But while I was down there, it was only a couple of months that Craig and Martin noticed my amount of interest in the subject. And there was some lads who'd come down the group who'd actually had an experience, a recent UFO sighting in another area of Birmingham called King's Winford. And I decided, I was just chatting with them down the group, and I decided it'd be really good to go out there to the location where they'd seen this thing, just go and actually just go there with them and see the location with my own eyes. And Craig and Mark got wind of this, and they approached me and said, well, would you like to write up a proper report on the case for Birmingham UFO Group, and we can get it out there? And I said, yeah, I'd be more than happy to. So just went out there for the night, didn't tell the witnesses that I was going to do this, but essentially throughout the night I took them to one side one at a time and essentially interviewed them about what they'd seen and got them to draw pictures, etc. And it was quite a compelling case. It was a good case. They'd essentially seen an octagonal shaped black craft that had come right over the clearing in the woods where they were situated. Very, very good multiple witness case. And that became my first official report for the group. So from that point onwards, I became the official investigator for Birmingham UFO Group. And the cases that were being reported to the group were getting sent to me, and I would speak with the witnesses and write up case reports. And sometimes that involved driving out to meet them directly, and other times, of course, in this virtual world, I could chat with them on the internet.
Isn't it great that you can talk to these people of what they went through, and you know, not be labeled crazy, or they can express what they've seen and feel through you?
That's it. Yeah, I mean, the problem is the stigma of the subject, which exists to this day and is, you know, very much on purpose. It's been initiated back in the 1950s and continues to this day, the ridicule of the subject. I mean, things have changed in recent years, but that, you know, that's a whole other colour fish. But yeah, there's still the stigma, especially in the UK. So there's a lot of people who are kind of automatically sceptical towards the subject and treat it as a bit of a joke. And I think many people like reaching out to me because I treat them seriously. And I don't go in thinking that they're just making it up from the off, you know, and that sort of thing. And I'll speak with them openly and honestly about what they've seen. I feel I'm quite a grounded researcher, so I'll quite happily tell people when they've seen something mundane. And there's a lot of things that are misinterpreted as something more unusual in the sky. Many, many UFO sightings can be explained away as these things, but there's still quite a few cases that I've looked into over the years, which are absolutely fascinating, some of which, of course, we're going to be getting into. But yeah, it was early in 2009 when they handed over the running of the group to me. So for Craig and Mark, it was a bit of a short-term thing, and they realised at that point that they weren't going to continue it long term, but they didn't want the group to die. So they approached me and said, would you like to take over the running of the group as well? And I gratefully accepted that. So from that point onwards, from 2009, I've been both the chairman and the lead investigator for Birmingham UFO Group. And there's another couple of researchers I've taken on as well, another couple of investigators who assist with some of the cases, and they come down our monthly group meetings. So as well as the investigative side, we've got a nice little community going where we have monthly meetings and we get speakers come and talk. Sometimes I'll give lectures, other times it'll just be I'll invite people to come and speak. And we also sometimes screen recent documentaries that have come out on the subject. So it's been really, really good fun over the years, and heard and seen many fascinating things.
What do you think that Birmingham, I mean, I've never been there, haven't been to the UK yet. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me on the stories I get from Birmingham, I mean, either be ghosts, spirits, or UFOs, it seems to be in a very active site, that area.
Yeah, it's quite well known for the area of Cannock Chase, which is essentially an area of rural land in the vicinity of the Birmingham area. And that's quite famous for having a lot of experiences that have gone on there. There's been some very, very big UFO cases that have occurred, including a massive flying triangle case that occurred in the mid-90s there that was investigated by the MOD, etc. Then there's also many reports of other strange goings on, ghosts and even stranger things still than that. And we've had a number of sky watches out of that location on purpose, because it's kind of known as an area where things take place. So we go to other places for sky watches too, but Cannock Chase is a favorite of ours.
Yeah, when you sent me your list of all these, not all, but I mean, a lot of these places that you investigated.
Yes,
I was like blown away. Like, you know, how do I pick? How do I pick which one that?
Yeah,
I mean, so we're going to start with the first one that I picked, and it was the 1993-2003 Ardington, Birmingham, England, the Flying Triangle.
So that's a local case, and this one's really fascinating, and it's a good choice to start with. Some very interesting aspects of this. So the case actually took place at some point between 1999 and 2003. And your listeners are probably thinking right now, you know, why couldn't the witnesses get more accurate than that 4-year window for when this took place? And there's a very valid reason for that, which we'll go into. The incident involved two witnesses, and one of the two witnesses used to come down to our monthly meetings, and that's how I found out about this incident that had happened to him. And at the time, he lived on a road called Holly Lane in Ardington. And across the road from where him and his family lived, there was this area of rough grassland, which him and his friend nicknamed the Tip. Him and his friend who lived in the neighbourhood, they would regularly go out to that area to walk the dog in the evenings and have sneaky cigarettes sometimes around their parents' backs. So this one particular evening, it's late evening, about 11 p.m., and the lights faded in the sky and the stars are out, so a clear, nice late evening. And they're there by the edge of Holly Lane, looking over towards the Tip, about to sort of walk the dog off in that direction, which they've got with them. And they spot in the distance three red lights in a triangular formation. And they're thinking, that looks a bit strange. Yeah, I mean, usually, obviously, with planes, you'd see white lights, maybe flashing strobe, maybe green in there as well, depending on the angle it was moving at. But it was essentially going from the right-hand side, just moving slowly to the left. And there also seemed to be a strange, slight wobble to it, almost some sort of distortion going on with the lights. And they were thinking, that doesn't look right for a plane or a helicopter. What is that? But they realized it was slowly moving in their direction. It was actually coming towards them. As this thing gets closer and closer, they're keeping their eye on it. And as it gets nearer, they realize that it's a triangular black colored object. The red lights are in the three corners in the base of the object. And there's no other lighting on it at all. And this thing just continues to approach. And they're just sitting there. They're just standing there in the road, amazed at what's going on. The thing essentially just comes towards them, and as it gets nearer, it starts to descend, and it comes over the fence on the far side of the road, and it literally descends and comes down and lands in front of them in the road within a stone's throw of them. And the thing's absolutely silent, and it hovers sort of a foot or two above the ground, so it didn't quite touch the actual ground, but essentially landed. at this point, the one of the witnesses starts to hear it making these strange sounds. He said it was kind of undulating sound coming from it. Reminded him a bit of the didgeridoo instrument. It was a kind of wong, wong, wong sort of continuous noise like that. Interestingly, when I interviewed the other witness later on, the other witness did not remember it making that sound at all. But other than that, their testimonies matched exactly. So they're looking at this thing, not knowing what to do, just staring down the street corner, looking at this thing in front of them. And at some point, the dog seems to get spooked by it and literally runs past the object and over to the far side where the witness's house is. The object remains there for up to 30 seconds or so, just hovering in front of them. And then it takes off, essentially, completely silently, lifts off the ground again, moves off at a diagonal, and it starts to move away, and it positions itself over the roof of the house of the key witness, the one who used to come down a group. By the way, if I'm not mentioning names, it's because the witnesses haven't allowed me. In some of the cases we'll go over, if I mention names, it means that they've allowed that. Essentially, it goes off over his house, and then it comes to a halt again, and now it's about sort of 10 foot above their chimney. And it's really interesting that it stopped over his particular house, of all places. And it remains there for a number of seconds and then takes off again and starts moving off behind the house, and they lose sight of it. So they want to keep watching it. So they run down a side road, and behind the house is an area of garden allotments. And when they go and look over the fence, the object's completely vanished. So within the seconds that they lost sight of it, it's just gone. Now, that happens quite regularly in cases. I've dealt with many cases where these objects will essentially get out of there at the brief moment when they're not being observed. It seems to happen far too often to be a coincidence. But you could say it was a coincidence in this case. Yeah, mm-hmm. But there's just many, many cases where this happens. Now things get really interesting. So this object's gone. And at this point, neither witness remembers what happened next. They assume that they must have gone back to their own houses and gone to bed. But in the morning, when they woke up, neither of them could remember the incident at all. It had been completely and utterly removed from their minds. The only sign that they ever had that something had taken place was that the dog didn't want to go over where the tip was. It seemed agitated, so it was like the dog could remember something had taken place, but they themselves couldn't. And even the dog doing this activity didn't jog their mind of what had happened at all. It only came back to them when the key witness had moved away from the address. So a number of years later, 2003, which is why it's that was the period of time. So in 2003, he moved house. And soon after he moved house, within weeks of him moving house, it suddenly came back to him one day, just like remembering an old memory. Like, let's say you go on holiday several years ago, and you think back to a memory from that. It was just like that. And he was like, how on earth did I forget that we saw this triangular thing come down in the road? So he rings his friend, and he says, do you remember when we saw that object come down, that triangular thing? And that jogs his friend's memory, and then his friend can also remember it. But it was only until he mentioned it to him. So it was really interesting that him moving away from the area for whatever reason brought it back to him. But while he was living at that address, he had no memory of it. Yeah, very, very interesting case. And you must have heard of missing time. It's a very, very regular aspect which is seen in contact cases. Most contact cases have got sort of fragmented memories. Either small parts of it is forgotten, but then there's cases like this where the entire incident is forgotten and then will later on come back. And it just makes you wonder what cases are out there that have occurred that people just have no memory of whatsoever because it hasn't come back to them. When the key witness thought back to that incident, when he thought back to that strange sound, it reminded him, he felt that he'd heard it at some point before, and he has memories of sitting in his room about 11 or 10 years old or something in his bedroom and hearing that same sound. And there were signs there that potentially he was a contactee and that the craft was there for him. This might explain why he could hear the sounds, but his friend couldn't. When it was landed in front of them. It's just speculation. I'm not saying that that's definitely the reason. I'm just speculating there. Now, we did actually try to regress the key witness afterwards. I work with a regressive hypnotherapist here in Birmingham, and he'll assist with certain cases. Now, hypnotherapy is obviously very controversial, and it's been scientifically proven that you can implant false memories in somebody while they're in that regressive state. However, if done correctly, it's a good way of getting back additional details on cases. And as long as the hypnotherapist isn't leading them in any way, they can sometimes come out with extra details. And sometimes missing memories can be retrieved under hypnosis. So we attempted this with a key witness, but unfortunately, he was quite active-minded and he couldn't slip into that meditative state well enough to be hypnotized, unfortunately. So we hit a bit of a brick wall with that one. He doesn't come down the group anymore for a number of years. He came down, then he just stopped coming and I lost contact with him. But it's an absolutely fascinating case. And the triangular-shaped craft in that, I've dealt with many, many other cases where that particular craft has been reported, even with exactly the same lighting configuration. It's one of the reasons why I believe that this is real. You know, I don't base my beliefs on just kind of hearsay or anything like that. You know, I feel like I'm quite grounded with the subject. I think that if anybody looks into the evidence of these cases that are on record in a serious manner, looks at all the similarities and links between them, they won't fail to understand that there's something real going on with this subject. You know, exactly what that is. And I mean, there's many, many unanswered questions. For example, the origins of these other intelligences. But one thing is certain, that it's actually going on and that it involves intelligences of some kind. And everybody's got their own views as to exactly what these beings are or exactly where they're from. And there's various evidence supporting that. I don't like to dismiss people's ideas outright because there's a lot of unanswered questions. But I think the important thing to realize is that it is happening.
Yeah, you just wonder if with these two witnesses that lost their memory, you just wonder if there was any type of mental telepathy going on with them too.
Yeah.
They would probably just, you know, they forgot it.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So the details that I've shared there is what the key witness and then later on his friend could remember of the experience. But that doesn't necessarily mean that there wasn't other things that had happened. Uh-huh. And to their knowledge, the object came down, remained there for a minute. God knows what it was doing. Maybe it was scanning them or something. And then it took off again. There was no knowledge that they'd been taken aboard it or anything like that. You can never remove that out of the equation because of the missing time aspect.
I'll be right back with case number 2 with Dave Hodrian right after these brief messages.
Hey guys, this is Vanessa. My podcast is Life Paranormal with Me. Listen as I serve you all things spirit, paranormal, and unexplained. Join me every other Saturday as my guest host and I recount our own experiences that will perplex and utterly terrify you. Life Paranormal with Me is available on all major platforms such as Anchor, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and many more. Join the Lifer fam by following me on Twitter at @VLifeParanormal. Follow, like, subscribe, and hit that notification button so you can always catch a ride on this spooky vibe.
Well, the next case I want to jump to is August 1987 in Sydney, Nova Scotia.
Yes.
On the dome discs.
Yes. So occasionally I'll get in cases from abroad. I'm happy to investigate cases from anywhere in the world because this is a global phenomenon. Obviously, a lot of the cases I deal with come from around the Birmingham area or the Midlands, which is the centre of England where Birmingham is. But I'll deal with cases from anywhere and have dealt with cases from as far reaching as Australia. This one's from Nova Scotia in a place called Sydney, and it involves a couple of witnesses. It's quite a serious case, and the reason for that is that one of the witnesses may well have died afterwards because of his close encounter with one of these objects. So it's quite a sensitive case. I first heard about this case in 2011, so this is one of the kind of more earlier sightings I looked into. And a man got in touch with me from Canada to report an incident that had happened to his friend who was then deceased and a second witness that his friend had known back at the time. So all the details were from this third party, essentially, that he'd been passed the information by his friend and he was passing that on to me. The incident apparently had happened in August of 1987. And the two witnesses involved at the time, they were down a place called Lingen Golf Course. This is a daylight sighting. This happened at 3 p.m. in the afternoon. So it was a nice, bright, sunny day. And they're just out there playing golf. There was probably some other golfers around, but none in the near vicinity to them. They happened to look up into the distance, and what they saw was two domed disks. The objects appeared to be sort of pewter grey, kind of a dark grey in colour. They had what appeared to be round portholes, windows around the edge of the dome that were black. And then there appeared to be some revolving white lights on the base of the objects. They couldn't see that too well at first, but later on they got a much better view of that were revolving around in a circle on the base of the object. Again, all those aspects I could link up with other cases that I've looked into. So the objects were moving in their direction and didn't appear to be that high up. I think they were between 60 to 80 feet up, so pretty darn low, much lower than a helicopter would generally fly at. Then as they were looking at these objects, amazed by them, of course, they then noticed further away behind the objects in the distance, several CF-18 fighter jets. And it became obvious that these jets were essentially performing an interception. They were attempting to approach these two UFOs. And they watched as these objects moved, and the jets were catching up, essentially. The jets were flying faster, and they're moving slowly in their direction. The jets get within a certain distance of these objects. All of a sudden, the objects just take off, shoot like a bullet, and they stop, and they fly towards them extremely fast and stop right over their heads. Now, it's unknown whether they did that because of the presence of these people below them and they were checking them out or what, but one of the two objects ended up directly over the gentleman who passed away. So it was right over his head. They reported that there was a low humming sound coming from the two objects. They're looking right up at them, obviously absolutely fascinated and shocked by what's taking place. They're just staring up at these things. And the objects apparently hovered motionless above them for a while. At this point, the jets are starting to close in again, of course, because they're still trying to intercept things. They're still trying to catch up. These objects suddenly shoot straight upwards, stop, and then just zip away off to the right, just out of view. And they're just gone. They're just leaving the jets in the dust trails, and they left the area entirely. And the jets just kind of fly off in the direction that these two objects had vanished in. It sounds like an absolutely wild story. And part of the, obviously, you've only got the witness testimony, as with a lot of cases, you've only got testimonial evidence. But one of the things that is compelling about this is what happened. So about 6 months after the incident, at this point in time, the witnesses hadn't talked about what had happened at all with anybody. They kept it to themselves for whatever reason. Maybe they were scared of repercussions or something because of the military involvement. Maybe they were scared they were going to be ridiculed, whatever. About 6 months later, his friend apparently developed leukemia, cancer of the blood. At this point, he started to talk openly about this close encounter that he'd had on the golf course. Both him and his family were absolutely convinced that this leukemia was a direct result of him being in close proximity to one of these objects, the fact that it was right over his head. The other witness wasn't directly under it, so the other witness did not catch leukemia, but he did. It's sadly, within another 6 months, his friend passed away from it, and to this day, his family believe that it was this close encounter with this UFO that had caused his death. Now, it's obviously a very sensitive case, so I could only kind of ask so many questions. I didn't want to offend anybody. Mm-hmm. One of the causes of leukemia is exposure to a radioactive object. That's one of the things that can cause leukemia. However, that said, the gentleman who died was a smoker, and one of the other causes of leukemia can be smoking. So it is possible that it was that had led to him getting the disease, not his close encounter, but we're never really going to know for sure on that one. But there's a possibility there. I mean, there are other cases on record where people have reported getting almost like sunburn from being in close proximity to these objects. There are other cases that I've become aware of, not ones I've investigated directly, but other ones where people have reportedly caught radiation-type illnesses from being in close proximity.
I was going to mention that, you know, because of radioactivity. I've heard, I know, I'm sure you heard about the cases, you know, where the UFO lands on an open field or a cornfield, and yep, they go in afterwards of the downcropped or trees, and yes, they have the radioactive, mm-hmm, you know, evidence.
Yeah, ground traces. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So it shows that some of these objects, and not necessarily all, because if you think about the many, many different vehicles we've got, mm-hmm, here on planet Earth, many different planes we've got, or cars, if you will, whatever you like, there's so many different types, and built in different ways, and using different fuel methods and that sort of thing. You know, so why wouldn't the same logic apply for for another species that was here. You know, it's possible that some of these craft are radioactive, and maybe being in close proximity to them under certain conditions can cause illnesses like this. I'm not saying that every single person who gets close to one of these craft would die. Otherwise, there'd be lots and lots of cases of this all the time. Quite a fascinating and sad case, really.
Like, the bottom line is, I never really did find out what that was.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, there was no... Obviously, this happened back in 1987, so it's very hard to follow it up. And because of the military involvement, it's very unlikely I would have got anywhere with that, you know, because it's very easy. If let's say I contacted a local base or whatever and said, you know, did you intercept some object? You know, it's very easy for them to just say, no, we didn't. Yeah, so unless you've got other witnesses coming forward backing that up, or maybe people kind of releasing radar information and that sort of thing, which we know has happened in some of the bigger cases on record, we hit a bit of a brick wall with it. And obviously, this was third party, so I was never able to speak with either of the two witnesses. The gentleman who got in touch with me was not friends with the second witness. So even though he'd heard it being talked about and him being present, there was no way for me to contact this other witness that had remained alive, and he's never come forward. I mean, the report's been out there on the BFOG website for years. And in certain cases, people do actually come back on my reports. We've had other witnesses come out the woodwork because they've gone looking online and have come across my case reports and have then got in touch. And it's really good. It's really good when that happens. I really like it when that happens. It kind of justifies, in a way, writing the reports in the first place and getting them out there.
I'll be back with case number 3 as I finish up my conversation with Dave Hodrian right after these brief messages.
The Mother Daughter Ish podcast and YouTube TV show is all about the conversations that mothers and daughters have, the conversations they don't like to have, and the conversations that just have to be discussed. Join us on all podcasting platforms. Watch our show on YouTube. Hey, guess what? It's your mama's favorite podcast and the podcast your daughter is so glad she found. Check out the Mother Daughter Ish podcast and YouTube TV show.
Okay, I'm back with Dave Hodrian. Like I said earlier, he's the chairman and investigator for the Birmingham UFO Group, and he's sharing some really, really great stories with us today. I'm going to put all his links in the bottom of this episode, but first we're going to get into Buxton, England. That one really fascinated me.
Yes. Yeah, so this is, as you mentioned at the start, I've dealt with a lot of contact cases, over 300 so far from around the world. And it's a particular aspect of the subject that absolutely fascinates me. And with the cases that we talked about previously, they've really just been sighting cases primarily. I mean, there was the aspects of the Erdington case that suggested that there might have been some form of contact. But this next case I'm going to go over with you is an absolutely incredible case from Buxton in Derbyshire, so North England. And it's one that I investigated quite a while back in 2010. It involves a lady and a partner, and I'm still in touch with them today. Absolutely lovely couple. The case involves quite a few different experiences, many cases with contact. Some of the more famous ones on record, take, for example, the Travis Walton abduction case, which many of your listeners will have heard of. It seems to revolve around one particular incident, one thing that happened. And if there was anything else that took place with that case, it's not widely publicized. However, more often than not, what I'm finding with contact cases is most of the time they're repeat cases, as in the individual that has had multiple experiences throughout their life, rather than it being an independent sole experience. And it usually goes right back to childhood. It can sometimes start as early as some of their earliest memories of actually being in the cot and seeing things, but it usually tends to start around age 5 or 6. And continues throughout their life. And there might be gaps in experiences. So there might be a number of years where they don't have any experiences at all. And there might be other points in time where they might get a number of different things happening quite quick succession. But it certainly appears to be an ongoing thing through their life, almost like they're being monitored by these beings. We're going to talk about some of the particular aspects from this case. I can't go through the entire case. If we go through every experience, it would easily run out of time. But we'll go through some of the main experiences that I want to focus on. And the first incident I want to discuss is absolutely fascinating, and it occurred right back in 1974, and it involves the landing and subsequent contact experience of a domed disc-shaped object. So the lady involved, she was only 12 years old at the time at secondary school, and that evening she'd gone out delivering some envelopes as a charity envelopes for the blind. And she was out there with her friend, and they were essentially walking around the neighborhood in the early hours of the evening. It was a very pleasant evening, and the sun hadn't gone down. She doesn't know the exact month in 1974 when it happened, but it sounds like sort of late summer, early autumn sort of time. They were walking along a particular road called Ecclesbourne Drive, and there's nobody else around. A lot of the time with these cases, you find that they occur when there's very few, if any, other people around. Might sometimes be a coincidence and sometimes not. They're walking along Ecclesbourne Drive, and either side of the road, there's bungalows. And they notice this object hovering over the bungalows to the right of the road ahead of them. And they're absolutely fascinated by it. Not particularly frightened by it. They're just like, what on earth is that? And it starts to arc in a loop around them completely silently, just goes around in a big arc. And as it's going around them, it starts to descend. So it ends up coming down and landing in the road in front of them. And you're seeing absolute parallels here with what happened in the case from Erdington that we were previously discussing. And you get that with cases again and again. You find these little details that match. There's a completely separate case with completely separate witnesses. Just like that case, the object did not touch the ground. It remained a short distance hovering above the road. It had rainbow-coloured flashing lights this time, multicoloured lights around the outer rim of the object. Other than that, it was just smooth and silver-coloured. There was no markings or anything else. In the base of the object, however, when she saw it come in, she said it had three circles, which looking back at it reminds her of an electric shaver that some people use. So you sort of three circles alongside each other in a triangular formation in the base of the thing. There's no what those things were or what they did. Essentially, this thing comes down, it's hovering in the road in front of them. Now, at this point, they see a doorway slide open in the side of the object. So there's this doorway, and inside it's just dark. And there's some kind of ramp comes down out of the base of this doorway. And here we've got a period of missing time. To her knowledge, she thinks something or someone came out of this craft and essentially took them aboard. She doesn't think they were forced or pulled aboard or anything like that. She thinks they were welcomed aboard, but she has no knowledge or memory of that taking place. One second they're in the road with this craft, with this open doorway in front of it, and the next thing they know, they're inside it, or they're, well, interpreted as being inside it, essentially. They're in a darkened area, and they're just standing there. They're alongside one another in exactly the same position they've been a moment before. They're still clothed. They look around to their right, so they weren't paralyzed or anything like that. They look around to their right, and what they see is a boy. He appeared to be about sort of 13 years old or something like that, and he was naked, and he was standing up, and he was in a trance-like state. So he was just had his eyes open, but it was not coherent at all. He was just standing there staring into space, essentially, and not saying anything. Now, at this point, it gets a bit blurred again. She thinks that they were separated. Her and her friend were separated and taken off to different areas. She remembers being taken along some kind of corridor, and what she remembers seeing quite clearly is a long cylinder filled with a pink liquid, and floating in this liquid was a human female, naked lady that she didn't recognize at all. And she didn't know whether she was dead or unconscious or what, but she's just floating there in this cylinder of liquid. And now I've been sent cases from other researchers that have matched that to the letter. So other people have described seeing exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
She then has this meeting, this conversation with a number of Nordic beings. And by Nordics, I mean blonde-haired humanoids. So they're reported very, very commonly. Obviously, the most recognizable species, the one that everybody knows, is what we call the greys with the large black eyes. And they are the most common species that are reported in abduction cases. And I will say species because there's certain very specific types that are reported that look quite different to one another. But the Nordics, as I call them, otherwise known as, sometimes called Pleiadians or humanoids, different referred to as different things. They look extremely human-like and the very, very sort of chiseled, beautiful features. She didn't have a clear recollection of them until she was hypnotized. She remembered that they were very beautiful. That's all that she could remember consciously. But under hypnosis, she described them in more depth. And she said there were four or five of them in these tight-fitting sort of blue jumpsuits. There was one who appeared to be some sort of leader who had a beard, and the other ones didn't. And she had a communication with them. She thinks it was telepathic. Again, it's kind of fragmented memories. She doesn't know whether they're talking audibly. And she, nor can she remember what was discussed. She just remembers that she was talking with them, but she couldn't remember what words were being said between them. However, she did view the whole scenario as quite positive. And some of the words that she did remember for was what happened at the end of that conversation. So she was quite happy to be there with them. It wasn't a frightening experience for her. It was quite friendly. And she realized that her time with them was coming to an end, essentially. And she actually asked this being when they would meet again. And she said, you know, will I ever see you again? And what the being said to her is absolutely fascinating. What he said to her, he said, you will, but only when you die. That's what that's what the being with the beard said to her. It's really, really interesting. So some kind of link there with the afterlife. It could be interpreted in a number of different ways, that, but that's what he said to her. Now, her next memory is of being back on the road again. She's back outside the craft and a friend's back there next to her. And they actually watch this object take off and lift up into the air silently and then essentially fly off extremely fast into the sky and go from sight. And they're left there alone on the road. They start to walk back to the house, discussing what had happened. Obviously, it's still in shock about it all. The more they talk about it, the more they're actually scared that if they told anybody that they would get in trouble, like the government or the Men in Black or whatever would come and get them. And that's why they didn't tell their parents about it when they got back. They kept it to themselves. The lady said that in the weeks following that, her friend became quite cold in discussing it and didn't want to discuss it anymore. It was like she was trying to block out the experience, like it had never happened. And after a while, she refused to talk to her about it. So that was essentially what had taken place. It's an absolutely fascinating experience there, involving a landing of this craft. And then essentially they were invited aboard. So they weren't, it's seemingly quite a positive experience rather than a more sort of frightening experience. Obviously, a lot of people, when they're taken aboard craft and experience abduction, it can be quite frightening. And a lot of the time, that's due to the fact that you're in a strange environment. There's odd-looking beings. They don't talk with you at all. Sometimes they might say a few words, but very cryptically. A lot of the time, it's very much like that. And I believe that a lot of the fear from those experiences comes from how bizarre it is. Not necessarily that it's evil, particularly evil in intent. But I don't want to offend anybody listening. If there's anybody listening who's had experiences and they view them in a very negative light, it's absolutely fine. You know, I fully understand that, because it really, really, it causes a lot of mental damage to people who experience this, especially when nobody will really believe them that it's taken place. And sometimes it can break families apart. And I've seen all that firsthand, and it's quite sad, really. That's what happened with that one. We're going to move forward to 1982 or 1983. So by this time, the lady involved is either 19 or 20 years old. She can't remember which of those 2 years it took place. In the year where it happened, she was very ill. She got glandular fever and would spend long periods of time lying on the sofa at her house on her own. She has a very particular memory of something that happened during this time. Now, some people could put this down to, oh, you just had this fever dream because you were ill at the time. But the aspects of this experience, I certainly believe that it's linked with contact and possibly with what happened before. We don't know. It's quite a number of years on now. What happened is she was lying on the sofa in the house and she remembers being brought a baby by a being. Now, interestingly, she can't remember what the being that brought the baby to her looked like. She has no memories. She had two arms and two legs, but that's about it. That's all she could remember. She was handed this baby, and when she looked at it, it looked quite young. It was female. It was a girl, but it wasn't fully human. essentially had large black eyes and thin black hair, very pale complexion. So essentially half, it was essentially a cross between a human and a grey. And she was allowed to hold this baby for quite a period of time. She thinks at least half an hour she was cradling this baby. And she recognized it as her own daughter. There was this mother-daughter connection thing, even though it didn't look fully human. After this point, the being then took it away from her. The baby was taken away from her. And it never gave her an explanation for why it was taking it away from her. It just did. And she remembers it going, she'd bottled this up for years and years. And this was all locked away. During the hypnotherapy session, we decided to explore this experience to see if she could remember any further details about what happened, like perhaps what this being looked like. And the amount of kind of built of trauma that came out through that regression, it was a pretty emotional moment, you know, for me, you know. Mm-hmm. I've never seen anything like that, you know, before firsthand, and it was quite difficult. And we would have called the regression, but the husband was there and said, you know, she needs to let this out, you know, I'm fine for you to continue, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was quite upsetting. And this is the kind of reality of the subject, you know, that it, you know, deeply affects people. You know, it's not people just trying to sell a story to the paper or anything like that. You know, this was obviously something that had really happened to her. And deeply affected her on an emotional level. It sounds wild, but I've dealt with other cases where pretty much exactly the same thing's been reported from completely different people, different ages. Usually women get bought these babies, but I've dealt with some cases where men have also had these babies bought to them. And it's one of the ongoing agendas, shall we say, that's observed with contact. And what it appears is that they are making these hybrid beings for, it's really unknown, really. I mean, there's obviously some contactees will have a view as to why they're making them and might have even been told directly by the beings, you know, we're making them for this particular purpose. But there might be more than one thing going on here, and we never really know whether the beings, whether they're, you know, being truthful themselves or sort of essentially telling a story to them to cover up something else. So we don't really know exactly why they're making these things. Some researchers view them in a very, very negative light and think that they're going to do some sort of takeover plot at some point and replace humans with these things. I don't really think there's no signs that that's going to happen. They might potentially be building them to populate another planet with or something like that, or maybe making some new race that has aspects of them and us for whatever reason. But I think that if there was something very nefarious like it, like that, we probably would have already seen it happen. Really, really interesting case. And there's another couple of UFO sightings and things like that that occur with the case, but these are the two main contact-related experiences that I wanted to discuss with you from that one. But obviously, if anybody's interested, the case report has not only these in great depth, but also including, incidentally, the transcripts of the regressions. She has a couple of body markings. There's a couple of unexplained scars that she's found on herself that she doesn't know how they appeared. We don't know if they're definitely linked with either of these experiences or other experiences that she can't remember. But yeah, that's another part of that case. And the photographs of those markings are again in that case report.
You are working on a board game.
Sure, yeah. Well, I've been an avid tabletop gamer for many years. I actually really like the getting around the table with friends and family, especially in this electronic age, you know, and you've got all video games and that sort of thing. But I decided a number of years ago that I'd start working on a UFO-themed card game. And what I've gone and created is essentially the most realistic portrayal of the real UFO subject ever released and ever seen in a tabletop game. It's a competitive card game for 1 to 6 players. So there is a solo mode in there, but it's primarily designed as a competitive thing. And the game's absolutely loaded with UFO lore. It's got so many aspects of the subject in there and references to famous cases and this sort of thing. We've taken it down a kind of a tongue-in-cheek route, so there's some fun cartoon artwork. I wanted to make it quite accessible, mm-hmm. not only to adults, but also older children. I've got an 11-year-old daughter, and I wanted her to enjoy it just as much as we do. The artwork has actually been created by an actual experiencer from New York. He's a guy who's had genuine contact experiences, and he's an artist, and I've reached out to him on purpose and was overjoyed when he said he'd be really happy to do the artwork for the game. And in the game, you actually play as an alien species, so you're actually playing as the Greys or as the Nordics or awesome. Whatever. And you actually have to perform activities and avoid the military and this sort of thing. And you use your powers and craft to kind of gain the upper hand and score more victory points than your opponents. So I'm very, very proud. I'm very proud of it. It's got mechanics which are quite different to most other card games out there. I believe it's quite unique. And we're in the final stages of it. We kickstarted it on the crowdfunding website Kickstarter last summer, and I'm very pleased to say that it was successful with that, which allowed me to make the game. Within the coming weeks, it's going to go live on Amazon.co.uk. I'm just in the process of literally setting that up at the moment and shipping the games to them. You've got the card game, and then there's also an optional playmat for it as well, which looks beautiful and is all covered in very detailed alien artwork. And it looks amazing with that, but that's an optional extra that you can also purchase.
What's the name of the game?
The game's called UFO Wave.
UFO Wave.
Yes, and there's an official website, which you said you were going to include the links. Mm-hmm. So ufowavegame.com. And on the website, you can not only see full playthroughs of the game and me describing lots of aspects of it. There's also a merchandise store on there with you can get, if you like the artwork, you can get T-shirts and mouse mats and all that with it. And I'm just really pleased that it's in the final stages and looking forward to getting it out there. Yeah, if you're interested in gaming yourself or know somebody who is and interested in the UFO subject, I think you'll find it really interesting.
They want to get a hold of you to actually come to maybe one of your meetings.
So the main website for our group is bufog.com. That's BUFOG.com. And on there, you can find details of all upcoming meetings. We usually kind of book them on there in advance for numerous months ahead. Our meetings take place on the first Thursday of every month. So the next one's going to be on Thursday, the 1st of December. This next one, we've actually got Swansea UFO Network coming up from Wales to talk about some Welsh UFO cases. They've spoken at the group before. So the meetings kick off at 7:30 in the evening and tend to go until about 11 or half 11 at night. There's free parking outside, and it's just in a function room of a snooker hall in Oldbury. Full address for the meetings are on the website, including details of nearby hotels if anybody wants to travel for any of the meetings. And everybody's welcome. You don't need to be an official member of the group or anything like that to come along. It's open to all. And we've got a lovely little community, some very open-minded, friendly people come down to that. If people can't make the meetings, either too far away or live in the States or wherever, that's absolutely fine. We've got a Facebook community page as well called Bufog Truth Seekers. I'm the main admin for that page, and I'll happily add anybody into that. So if you're listening and you want to get involved, by all means, join the Facebook group, and you can ask me questions directly or post links to interesting things. And obviously, as the admin for the group, I make sure that there's no nonsense in there or ridicule or anything like that. Yeah, there's about 1,400 members in there at the moment, many group members and many other people as well who use Facebook. We've also got our organisation page, which is on Facebook as well, which I put details of upcoming meetings, and I'll also release the case reports via. New case reports will also go out on Bufog Truth Seekers, and will also be publicised on the site itself, of course. And on the website, you can find literally hundreds of cases, including the three we've gone over in this talk. They're all on there. There's a search facility, so you can look for particular cases from particular alert years or locations. So go and have a look, go and have a mooch around the site and see what you find. There's a sighting report form on the site as well. So if you had an experience and you want to share it with me and want me to investigate your case, I'm more than happy to do so. As I said, it doesn't matter where you live in the world. I can reach out to you via video or audio call via the internet. And we can chat away. I'll happily speak to people about their experiences. And I'm happy to provide support without the report. By the way, the report isn't an essential if you want to just talk with me about something you've seen, but you're not happy with me releasing a report on the details. That's also absolutely fine, because I understand the stigma of this subject more than most people do.
Yeah, that was my next question, is if somebody wants to talk to you, but don't want to go public with it, how can they contact you personally on something that affects them personally?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not like a journalist, you know. I have my absolute trust. You can reach out to me in full confidence, and I won't share details without, which is why I didn't mention the people's names in those cases we've just gone over. Any details that the witness doesn't want released will not get released. And that goes right to the point of not releasing entire experiences if they're not happy about it. So if they think that maybe it might lead back to somebody finding out who they are. And most people, they're not in this for the fame or fortune. Obviously, there's a few people out there who are out to, you know, sell it to the highest bidder or whatever. But most people are talking about real things that have happened to them and just want to share those details and get the information out. Maybe try to see if there's other people out there who've also seen the same thing. And I'm more than happy to provide that support. I won't just take every single word that somebody tells me and then put it out online. I have my absolute strictest confidence on that.
Well, Dave, I really appreciate the stories today, and I really can't wait till you come on again next week, and we're going to go into part two of the series. You know, I could probably do a whole year of this. Thank you again, man, for coming on. We'll talk again next week.
Excellent. Look forward to it. Thank you all.
This finishes part one of my interview with Dave Hodrian. I will have all of Dave's links at the bottom of this episode. Please check out his site and his board game links and everything else is down in there. And I'll be back next week with part two of my conversation with Dave Hodrian when we talk about UFOs, hybrids, implants, and a whole lot more. I'm your host, Al Cooley, host of Ghost in the Valley podcast.